Look at that. See, yesterday's in my life. Catching up. It is a privilege to be here. From the very moment the plane landed, I had a few words of wisdom. In that, when I was in Dallas, I called Gracie and David A. And David's words were, and Gracie's, what the heck are you doing there from Ohio when everybody else there is from California and they snuck one in from their own state? I don't know. God does peculiar things. But I want, well, it's just a privilege to be here and I can't express it. It's real hard for me. But I've seen a lot of people that I have met over the years, from the privilege of being asked to speak in Texas. And one of the biggest blessings of Alcoholics Anonymous is walking into a room and never having that feeling that you're by yourself. That friendships that you make, no matter how long they last, you know, which is an eternity in AA, no matter how long you're with somebody, you're a friend for life. And it's just like meeting them in the yesterdays of your life. I have a message from you from my 10-year-old granddaughter. My kids called me this morning. And my 10-year-old granddaughter got on the phone. She's at the house for the weekend. And she said, "Grandma, you tell them what fun it is to be an AA, AA, AA." Now, I don't know about AA, 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 but I do know she enjoys going to meetings and she loves it because of the laughter. She loves it because of the happiness. She loves it because of the feeling in the room. And that's the way it is. It's a miracle to walk in any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is a privilege. You look around this room and none of us ought to be here. The ones that are in Al-Anon and Alateen should be in insane asylums. The rest of us should be dead or under a bridge or locked up as well. And it's only by the grace of God and the power of this program that we sit in this room. And I believe, way down deep in my heart, that to walk into a room, no matter where, that has people in it like us, that are recovering people in Alcoholics Anonymous, working as hard as we can on those beautiful 12 steps of recovery that John talked about so beautifully last night, that it's a spiritual experience. It's okay. So, my name is Beth Gordon. I'm an alcoholic. Good morning. And by the grace of God and the power of this program, I have not found it necessary to pick up a drink or take any kind of a drug since March the 5th of 1972. And for that, I am grateful to you. I am also very warm. I left 44 degrees and came into this. And also, this reminds me of where they wanted to stick me one day in the workhouse, where everybody wore stripes, and that's the way it is. I know one thing for sure. I know that the woman I was will drink again. There's no doubt in my mind about that. And that's why it is so important to me to try the best that I can do in each 24 hours to live in a sober way that I never could live in before. And I make mistakes. I mean, I'm not standing up here because I'm perfect. I'm standing up here because I make mistakes. And that's the thing that my sponsor told me, it's okay. You know, you just go back and it's like a kid that falls off their bicycle. You know, and they scrape their knee and then they get right back up on that bicycle and they keep going. And that's exactly what you have to do. You try and you learn from your mistakes, and that's real, real important to me. The serenity prayer that we said before this meeting is also very important to me, and I bet I wear it out every day. It brings me right back to things that I better look at, things that I better do, things that I have learned in these meeting rooms, things that I have learned from talking and listening, things that I have learned from being with people in Alcoholics Anonymous, people in Al-Anon. I know some Al-Anons that run rings around my program. Al-Anon just wasn't when I was little. There wasn't anything like that, and I could have used it. But I learned from everybody and anybody that are in these rooms, and that's important. And that serenity prayer says the big deal to me. I'm the problem. It wasn't where I was born, who brought me up, how they brought me up, what they did, who I married, what kind of a job I had, anybody else in my whole life. The problem is right here, and it's the only thing that I can change. And sometimes I hate to think about that. You know, sometimes I really mess up and try to change other people because I'm human, and then I get uncomfortable, and I don't like feeling uncomfortable inside. I don't like it at all. It's real important to me to be comfortable in this way of life. I spent too many years in a discomfort. And the serenity prayer says to me, I'm the problem, and all I can do is change myself. And today I really don't want to change you, because how would I learn anything if everybody thought and was just exactly like I am? It would be impossible. And that's another blessing of the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's another blessing of coming in these rooms and listening and hearing to that one thing of value that's going to help me sometime down the road. And I still do the same thing I was told to do in the beginning. My sponsor said that if you take the cotton out of your ears and you shove it in your mouth and you listen and you hear what's said, one thing is going to hit you. Somewhere within those walls of an AA meeting, either in the fellowship before, in the fellowship afterward, from the speaker, we have comments up north in our meetings, from those, from anything. When it hits you, write it down, and it'll hit you. And then go home and rewrite it down, because you probably will lose the piece of paper you wrote it down on in the first place. And I have two notebooks that are like this that have the one thing of value that I have picked up from every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous since I walked through those doors. And I leaf through that, and I learn from that, and it always seems to take me back to basics. Always. And the wisdom to know the difference, I was told, is going to come with a lot of time and a lot of mistakes. And I used to think, you know, I'll get there. Someday I'll get there. And my sponsor said, where? And I said, you know, there. And they said, we don't know where that is. But if you try to get there, and that's all you're thinking about, you're going to miss the scenery. And Beth, the scenery is what holds this whole thing together. Start looking out the window instead of being so darn interested in getting into the blasted station, or you're going to miss life. And what you were given was a gift for another chance in life. And I believe them. I believe them. And I, you know, I mouthed off. And I said, I'll get there the day I die. You know, and my sponsor said, my dear, let me tell you something. The day you die, you go to the big meeting in the sky, and when you walk through those gates, honey, you go in as a new person and you start all over again. So there isn't any getting it all together. And boy, have I found that out. I found that out a couple of weeks ago. I found myself up in the middle of the night pacing the floor, with sweat running down my back, with I couldn't sleep. I was having a real tough time of it. And I thought to myself, what are you doing? I didn't like my thinking. My thinking was going back to where it was one time. And I didn't like that at all, because I was starting to feel uncomfortable. And it was because somebody that I care a lot about somebody that I actually love, and today I know what love is. It's doing for others and not asking and not asking for anything in return. And you've taught me that. I never knew that before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody was just screwing me blind. And what I was worrying about is, how am I going to pay the mortgage? How am I going to do this? How am I going to do that? And material things were getting in the way of spiritual things, and it was showing up right in here. And so I did the only thing that I could do. I sat down and I wrote steps 1 through 5. I gave them, or 1 through 4, and I gave my 5th step to about this whole thing to my sponsor, and it went away. That again is something basic, because I was able, when I did that, to get this running in a straight line and to make a decision and carry it through. And I thought to myself, by God, you belong in those meetings. You belong listening. You belong back to the basics. And I learned what to do through an incident that happened in a hospital 3 weeks ago when my grandson was born. And I was full of stress and everything about this other thing, but I had told my I have never missed the birth of one of my grandchildren because I've been sober. And I've been there, and I've seen every single one of them when they were 10 minutes old. And that's by the grace of God in this program. Because I really didn't have as much feeling as I have towards them when I was drinking. But I was standing there, and I was looking at little Ryan. And this boy that I found out was 21 years old was standing next to me, and he said, "My, he's a handsome boy." And I said, "Yes, he is." And I said, "Are you a new father?" And he said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "Would you come around and see my baby?" And I said, "I'd be delighted. Thank you for asking me." And he said, "Well, my parents and my wife's parents won't come." And he said, maybe if I check out with the nurses, you could go in and you could hold him so he might know what it would be like to be held by a grandmother. And I said, "I'd be delighted to." And I walked with this 21-year-old boy around the corner, and I met his wife, who was standing there, and I found myself looking into the face of a mongoloid baby. And this boy said to me, when I was holding this little baby in scrubs in a rocking chair and rocking him back and forth, this boy said to me, "Isn't it beautiful that God has chosen my wife and I to take care of one of his special children?" That's when I thought to myself, here you have 12 steps of recovery. You're not using them. You're not doing what you should do. And I believe that God put that family in my life to bring me right back to what I should do. Life is a learning experience, and I just don't learn from in here. There's people out there that I can learn from as well. If I'm willing to learn, if I'm listening to what they're saying. And that is one of the privileges and one of the blessings from staying in these meeting rooms. And it wasn't all like that. We're supposed to tell a little bit about what it was like. And I, you know, obviously we all know what it's like or we wouldn't be here. I mean, we just didn't drop in, you know. So I'll try to zap through that thing as fast as I can. I was brought up with it, and so what? It's the way I feel. Not everybody drank. I mean, I had a stepfather that didn't drink, that probably was blessed and lived these 12 steps. And I could have talked to him about how I was feeling. I didn't choose to. I didn't choose to. You know, I stuffed everything inside, and I used to hide behind the fact that my mother came from Scotland, and Scotch people just don't tell anybody anything. It's none of your damn business. You know how we feel. And that's what I used. And I always, darn it, wanted to feel like you looked. I'd see you looking ha-ha-ha, and I'd go ha-ha-ha, and I didn't feel like you looked. And you'd cry, and I'd boo-hoo. I had wonderful time boo-hooing. You know, if you boo-hoo enough, and you walk on your face enough, people say, oh, what's the matter with you? You know, that's why my sponsors made me read Winnie the Pooh when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I kid you not. You know, it's a big book, 24-hour book, Winnie the Pooh. And the little engine that could. And if you're new, read Winnie the Pooh. I make all the people I sponsor read Winnie the Pooh because there's a character in there called Eeyore. And he lives behind a fence. He's a donkey, and he's got a tail with a nice red ribbon about it. His problem is he always thinks it's missing. And he keeps his face down, and he whines. And my sponsor said, we take a lot, but no whining, so you don't want to be like Eeyore. And that's what I was when I was growing up. I got a lot of attention doing that. And I stuffed everything inside. And I married probably the finest man that ever walked the face of this earth. Another person who lived the 12 steps without being an alcoholic. It was his way of life. And I was uncomfortable. I didn't like being married. I thought everything was going to be my way, you know. And it wasn't. It's a two-way street, boy. It's a give-and-take deal. And I wanted to take and not give. And I didn't feel like all my friends looked that were married. It's just that simple. So one day at a party, somebody said to me, why don't you learn how to smile? You know, I never smiled. I didn't smile till I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and my sponsor said to me, while you're running around all these meetings and reading your big book, your 24-hour book, Winnie the Pooh, and the little engine that could, why don't you smile and give your face something to do so it doesn't feel left out? You know, so I started to smile, but I didn't, you know, I just, he said to me, why don't you learn how to smile? Why don't you learn how to be happy? Why don't you have a drink? And he held it out and my arm shot out and I picked up that thing and I'll never forget that. And I don't want to forget it. Because the day I forget that, and that is why I'm here, is the day I'm going to start going downhill. And I remember it. It was a Manhattan on a rocks. And it had a lot of garbage in it. It had cherries and bananas, you know, all those things. And I drank that. And I want to tell you, just like you were told last night, it warmed going all the way. I really didn't like it that much, to tell you the truth. Well, you know, but, and why do we, you know, it doesn't really taste good. It's what it did in here. And it warmed me up. And this could go, and I wasn't worried about what anybody else thought. And I started to feel like you looked. I could go, uh-huh. And I knew that's how you felt on the inside, like I was feeling. And the best thing of all was I went into the bathroom, and I looked in the mirror, and by God, I looked like Elizabeth Taylor. And I thought, if this does that to me, then hit him. Those feelings lasted for about 3 weeks. And then alcohol started to remove from my life. And the only way I can explain it is that if you write on a page with pencil and you use an art gum eraser, and don't kid yourself, some of you sitting here are old enough to remember what an art gum eraser is. And if you don't know what it is, go to a store and get one. It's a fat thing, and when you erase with it, it fades. It doesn't immediately take it off like the eraser on a paper. It fades. It fades it until it's all gone. And that's exactly what alcohol did in my life. It started to fade those parts of me that were okay, until they were all gone, and I didn't even know it was happening. By the time I had been drinking 5 years, my husband looked at me, and he said, you have a drinking problem. I can't stand, you know, I'd be standing with my back to the door, and he'd walk in, and he'd say, you've been drinking, looking at my back. I never have been able to figure that one out, and I got to ask somebody in Al-Anon how that works. I mean, do we have a sign on our back that says she's been drinking today, or what happens? But would I get mad, and that would give me an excuse to continue on with what I'd been doing, and I hadn't done anything that bad. I didn't think I was in trouble. I was still living at home. I had no job to lose. I hadn't been picked up by the police. You know, I'd had nothing. The only thing I'd done was I'd found wine. And I'm a wino, and I don't, you know, that doesn't do anything to me. Could mean I'm a wino. I loved it. It was rocket juice. By God, it got me where I was going faster. They spend millions at NASA wondering how they're going to get us on the moon and the Mars and the Jupiter. I'll tell you one thing. If I got one drink of that stuff and I was on Uranus, and nobody ever asked me why, planting the flag and plowing the dirt, I was doing it all. I could have saved them millions, but they didn't care to ask me. So anyway, it was cheap, it was accessible. Because when I was drinking alcohol, the tough stuff, like the scotch and the bourbon and all that stuff, see, you had to sign your name. In Ohio, you had to go into a state liquor store and you had to sign your name and sign down what you wanted and hand it to them. And I had started forging. Like I was Emma Glutz sometimes, I was Tizzy Lish other times, because I didn't want the FBI coming to look for me. Now what the Sam Hill the FBI was going to want with a little old housewife in Brecksville, Ohio, I don't know. But I thought, well, this has got to switch. And then I discovered wine. And not only was it rocket juice, but it's cheap, it's accessible. God, they even had it in a hardware store I went into up there. You go in and, God, it'd come out oiled, huh? Anyway, but it came in large economy sizes that you could dump in another little bottle. It came in pints that you could stick down your front and you didn't bulge when you went into the house. And I used to, and I had no trouble with step two, believe me, I used to hide it. That's what we do. We don't want to be found out, so we hide it. And so I decided one day that I was going to start painting them white, the bottles. And so I'd paint them white, and then I'd hang them one at a time out the second story window on a white rope, because we lived in a white house. And I went out in front and checked that I couldn't see them hanging out there. And so it was easier to hoover on the second floor, because I used to make maps of where I'd hidden it, and I used to write myself instructions, but it was getting to the point I couldn't read what I had written the night before, and some of you will be able to identify with that. And so I would hang these out. You know, and I'd paint them green and put them in the pine trees, and I'd do all that stuff. And one day, he said to me, "Come out here in this front yard. What is that?" And I went out there and I said, "I don't know what you're talking about. I don't see anything." He said, "You stay right there. I'm going down the street and get Marty." Marty was his best friend. He said, "Don't move." And I promised him. You know, I won't. I promise. And he left. And the minute he was gone, I shot hundreds of miles an hour up those stairs, grabbed the thing in, stuck it underneath the bed, ran right back down into the front yard and was standing there not even breathing hard when he came back with Marty. And he said, "Marty, do you see what she's doing to our family? Look. She's painting the damn things and hanging them out the window." And Marty looked and he said, "Bruce, I think maybe you ought to go to a psychologist. I don't see a thing." And we don't play games. No wonder they say they're sicker than we are, you know? God. Anyway, you know, and I'd hide it like in the douchebag in the enema bottle. Men don't know what they missed. Oh. You know, you could hang it up there and nobody's going to go looking in it. And then all you need to do is to undo the little hose and hold the thing up here and down it comes. That's the way it was. So I was doing, you know, and I was forging checks and doing a few things like that. So I went around AA the first to three times. I walked into these meeting rooms, I wasn't honest. It was always their fault, his fault, her fault. And I didn't have an open mind. I heard what you said. You were in jail, you lost your family, you lost your job. That hadn't happened to me yet, and I think yet's one of the most important words we have. If it hasn't happened, it will. I swear to you, if you walk out those doors and go back to whatever you were using, and I say that today because there's a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous who stuck stuff in their arms, stuck it up their nose, whammed it in their belly button, you know, and put it in their mouth in pill form, and I don't care what you did, a drug's a drug's a drug as far as I'm concerned. It's just that alcohol happens to be still socially accepted. Look on the billboards. You want to look like a beautiful blonde in a black velvet dress? And she's holding a Seagram's or something? But alcohol was it for me, because the other stuff wasn't on the market. Oh, it did come on the market in the 60s, Librium and Valium. And I went to the doctor once, and I was shaken apart, and I said, I am so nervous and so upset, and things aren't going, blah, blah, blah. I need something that's going to calm myself down. And I read about this stuff called Valium. And the doctor looked at me, and his brother, his father, and two sisters, I found out later, had years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he looked at me and he said, if you don't want to be nervous anymore, he said, you leave this office, you buy the dirtiest book you can find, you go home, you lie down, put your feet up, read the book, and you won't be nervous. And he wouldn't give me Valium. But I used to go to the neighbors' houses, and I'd go into their medicine chest, and there it was. But it hadn't happened yet. And I wasn't willing to do a few simple things you asked. And that, to me, is how it works. And I'm not speaking for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just telling you what I think and how I feel. The next time was 2 years later. The social service workers were in a house. You can't have kids going to school in a foot of snow with no socks on and in only a little spring jacket. You can't have kids going to school telling their teacher they're hungry because there wasn't enough in the house. And no, they didn't say their mother had a drinking problem, that their mother was always drunk. Because kids don't talk about it. They don't say anything about it. You just don't. Because they don't know any other way to go. And my husband was a sales engineer, and he was out doing the responsible thing. He was doing his job. And the neighbors couldn't bird dog with the blinds shut, the doors locked, and told in no uncertain terms to stay away, that nothing was their business. So social service workers came, and they threatened that I was going to lose my children, even if I was married, if I didn't do something. And I went around AA again and played the same game. One meeting a week. I have never met a kid who's gone once a week to school and has ever graduated. I cannot live on one meeting a week. I still go to a minimum of three. I usually hit four. And I have to do that because I've got a job and all those other things. But this is where it's at. This is our classroom. This is our chemotherapy for our disease. And 4 years later, a judge looked at me over a thing like this, and he said, 90 days in the workhouse, or you go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd had 90 WIs, and I was up on a very bad assault and battery charge. The Summit County Sheriff had stopped me, had asked to take me home. And he knew what the problem was. There was an empty fifth of wine in the car. There was another one that was undone. And there was a full bottle still in there. And I didn't want him to take me home. What would the neighbors think? The neighbors think they'd probably have thrown the biggest block party in history. And you know, and I, oh, poor me. And he insisted, and I got madder, and so I hit him over the head with my wine bottle. And he got 24 stitches in his head, and I got chained to this matron, and I got my picture taken with numbers under my neck. And this judge said, you go to Alcoholics Anonymous, or I'm throwing you in the workhouse. And they had stripes, and I didn't like the way they went. And I thought, why does anybody like me belong in the workhouse? So I went around and I played the same game. And the next 4 years were hell. Hell on wheels. And you've been there, all the fear, all the loneliness, all the guilt. Becomes too much for you, so the day comes when you just don't care. I just look out the window and watch the kids in the neighborhood going to school. Their mothers were out there, and they were holding their kids with their by the hand, and they were laughing. God, their hair shone. And they looked so healthy. And I wanted my hair to shine, and I wanted to look like that, and I wanted to feel like they looked. And I didn't understand why. And the pain would be so horrible when I'd see my children standing away from everybody, because who wants their kids to play with the kids of a drunk after a while? The pain was so bad. I do the only thing that I knew what to do was to drink. So I like to remember March the 4th of 1972, because it was on that day that I believe today that God moved in to that little part of my soul that was still left. And I believe this is the sickness of the soul. And God moved in, and I didn't even call him. That was his grace alone. And that's never going to happen again. And that's why I have to go back to basics. That's why I have to do the things that I have to do each day in order to stay sober, because I don't want to take that chance. I don't want to get careless with this. You know, it's almost, it's being given a gift. It's like you're given a Monopoly set at Christmas, and you pick it up when you're done with it. You put the hotels back and the houses back and the community chests back and everything, and you take care of it. And then the next time you take it down from the shelf, you can play with it. And then the day comes when you get careless and you take it down from the shelf, you can't play with it anymore, because you got careless and the gift is gone. That's the same way it is with this, I believe. It wasn't because I had lost most of my body hair. What's grown back is none of your business. It wasn't because I had wine sores and they were running. It isn't because I weighed 62 pounds. I just knew I was dying. And I knew that after my family left for church, I had finished what was in the house that morning. And it was the first time I didn't have that horrible feeling that I wanted something else. It wasn't when I didn't have to go drink rubbing alcohol or cologne or the extracts to hold me over until I could walk barefooted sometimes to a store and buy more. It was gone. And I watched that family of mine go to church, and everything I had said and done and everything that I had become were written all over their faces. And that is a grace I was given from God, as I understand him, to be able to see that, to have that little part of me that was still his open up and see this. Nobody said goodbye. They quit talking to me a long time ago. And I knew that everything ugly in my life was because of me. Because I am an alcoholic. And I wanted to live. And I called to the phone, and I called my Aunt Jean in Chicago at that time, had 9 years of uninterrupted sobriety, and I told her that I wanted to live. I knew I was dying. And she asked me the name of an old-timer who had never given up hope on me, and his name is Jerry Jackson. And Jerry died in 1978 with 30-some years of uninterrupted sobriety. I had met Jerry in 1962 when I went around Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time. And Jerry had taken a liking to my family. Jerry had come over and given them that kind of hope that literally glued them together. The same as our traditions do to us. They glue together. I could smell Jerry coming when he left his house, which was 5 miles away. We had that. You know, we do that. I could smell him coming, and I'd go upstairs and lock my door. I'd go up to the attic and lock the door, or I'd just go outside and sit. He didn't want to see me. He knew what was going on, but he wanted to give my family that hope. And I found out what kind of hope that is. And that's the same kind of hope we hang on to by our fingernails when the chips are down. And I found that out when I was cleaning my house, when I'd been sober for a while and could get back to doing things like that. And I swatted a cobweb out of a corner of the living room, and that little spider fell, whoop, down on some kind of an invisible thread. And I put the mop back to hit him, because I'm sorry, but I can't stand those things. Like somebody was telling me this morning, oh, you ought to go out a couple of miles beyond town, there's rattlesnakes. I came here to learn how to stay sober. I didn't come here to blow my mind watching rattlesnakes. Anyway, you know, if you don't trouble trouble, trouble won't trouble you. Anyway, so here he was swinging, and I couldn't hit him. And I thought, he's hanging on to something with a hope that he can climb and rebuild what has just been destroyed. And I watched him. I didn't stand there like a stupid and watch him, you know, do nothing else, because it takes them a couple of days. But every time I'd go through there, I'd watch him, and he put one fuzzy foot over the other and trudged his way up that invisible something, and he rebuilt that beautiful web, and it was more powerful and bigger and more beautiful than it had been before. When the sun would go through it, it would almost make like a spectrum. That's the kind of hope. That's the kind of hope that I had to be brought back to a couple of weeks ago when I was getting all this stress and all this stuff and putting things in front of things and not doing the things that I was supposed to. And that's the kind of hope that I hang on to after a decision was made. And it's because of you, grace of God, and this program. Jerry said to me, it's not going to be easy, because nothing in life that's worthwhile is easy. But if you'll take our hands and you'll trudge along this road with us, I promise you something, it'll get better. And today I know what better is. Better is being able to feel better in here. Better is being able to do the things we have to do on a daily basis to make this comfortable. Better is sharing with somebody who is brand new and giving them again that hope that if you do a certain simple little ditties, it's going to be all right. And it's learning from what we're saying. I learn from the people I sponsor, just like I learned from the old timers, just like I learned from the people who have trudged the road. And I have never had a feeling that I had to sit on a rock and wait for somebody to catch up. I have never had a feeling that I had to run to catch up myself. It's sort of like we're going on this road together, learning from each other. A day at a time, and that's so important to me. Then Kamikaze, the sponsors. In the house they came. You know, pick your own sponsor if you can. God, you know, don't take the chance. In they came. And they told me everything I didn't want anybody to know about. And all they were doing was sharing their story with me. That's all they were doing. Then they got in the corner and they said, oh, yeah, she's sick. What a sick she'll go. Oh, she can last. They started calling. Three places. That's all that there were. There was St. Thomas Hospital in Akron. They had a 4.5-week waiting list for a woman's bed. They called Rosary Hall. Up in Cleveland, Rosary Hall had shut down its 5-woman's bed because they were painting the rooms pink and hanging polka dotty curtains to reopen or something. And they called Serenity Hall, which was the other one, and Serenity Hall didn't even take women. And so they figured that nobody had ever died on them yet, and by God, nobody was going to start. So off we went. We went to 2 and 3 meetings a day, 7 days a week. And I continued to do that. And they picked me once. I called and said, I'm so tired. I just can't go. And I have never heard silence like that in my life. Nothing breathed, nothing on the other end of this phone. And finally, this voice said to me, if you think you're tired, what do you think we are? We'll be there in 10. I never said another word. Never. So he did that. 2 and 3 meetings a day, 7 days a week. 9 months of sobriety, they brought me street maps of every county in the state of Ohio, and they brought me meeting lists from everywhere in Ohio. They plunked them on the counter, and they said, get in your car and go, or stay home and get drunk. That's your classroom. And I went myself, and I picked them up and took them. And we always went in a carload. Still the same thing, 2 and 3 meetings a day, 7 days a week. And that's how it had to be. And it was in these meeting rooms I learned things like the word we. God, is that important? We are powerless over alcohol. Our lives. We. Our. Us. And that made me feel like I wasn't alone. The first meeting I went to, they literally supported me up steps. I was going back into a meeting that I literally had lied in, that I had left and gone out into a car and pulled that damn bottle out from under the seat and drank. And I didn't know what to expect. And I went back up in there, and you know what I got? I got a handshake. Somebody took my very cold hand in their warm one and they said, welcome. Now, was it fun out there? What turkey? So I don't know what I'd done if anybody would have said that. But we're glad to see you. That handshake's important. Real important. That may be the only connection for the new person. That was the first physical contact I'd had in years. And then I heard the Serenity Prayer. And I knew I'd heard that somewhere, and I made my mouth move up and down and sounds come out so you'd think I knew it and would like me. And my sponsor gave it to me in the elbow, in the rib cage for the first time, and she said, you don't need to pretend in here, Beth. You don't need to pretend. I'll promise you something. If you stay in these meeting rooms with the cotton out of your ears and into your mouth, and you listen and hear what's said, the day will come when you can say the Serenity Prayer. And that day came. And I remember the meeting, and I remember who was at the table when I could say the Serenity Prayer. And I believed in you. You had told me to stay there. You had told me what to do. And the end results were, I knew the Serenity Prayer, and I could say it in the name, and I knew explain, like I said in the beginning. It was in those meeting rooms that I learned simple basics that I go back to all the time. Stay away from the first drink one day at a time. God, I never had one drink in my life. I wasn't a social drinker like John. You know, I wasn't a social drinker. The closest I ever came to being one of those was when somebody said, I think I'll have another drink, and I said, so shall I, and got on with it. You know? And I didn't understand what they were saying. So they invited me out of the meeting across the field, and they said, go sit on some railroad tracks. And when the choo-choo comes along and runs into you, then you get up off the track, and you come back in here, and you tell us how we feel. I said, I can't. I'll be dead. I said, I'll be dead when the engine hits me, and the whole room exploded. Hooray! It's the engine that kills you, honey. It's not the caboose. It's the first drink that pulls something up here over which we have no control. And after this meeting, if anybody says to me, what if the caboose is coming first, I'll punch your lights out. You told me not to intellectualize, not to tear apart, just to accept. And where I come from, and as long as I've been alive, when Lincoln was president of the United States, I'm not totally honest, the engine has always pulled it. It's the engine that does it. It's the first one. And I couldn't stay away from the first one day at a time. I have never been able to work this program one day at a time. I got to do it right now. Now I know what I'm feeling. Now I know how I'm thinking. It was those nows that I felt that stress. And now I had to do something about it. Because I let those feelings of 2 weeks ago go for a week. And look what happened. This was screwing up. Everything was going wrong, and that brought me right back to, I've got to live right now. And you taught me what to do right now. You taught me about 25 phone numbers by the telephone. I said, I have an address book. You said, hey, when this starts going around, hi, Sam Hill, are you going to remember where you put your little address book? If you have them up there by the phone, you can just pick up the darn thing and dial. Or punch. Whatever it is. And they said the reason for 25 is because of the first number is busy. You won't think, oh, poor me. I need them. They're talking to somebody else. Boo-hoo. And get resentful. If you go on to the second one, and they happen to be out living, and their phone rings, and they're not home, you're not going to get boo-hoo. You can keep going. Somebody's going to be home. Somebody's going to answer that phone. Somebody's going to listen and hear what you aren't saying. And I still have 25 phone numbers by my phone. And under my phone at work, and under my phone in the second floor. And they've changed over the years because people have gotten to the big meeting in the sky. Some have moved. I need that. I still need that. He said, get out of yourself. Go do something for somebody else. You've been whammed into this thing for too long. When somebody's coming towards you, walking on their face, smile. Have you ever done that? Have you ever walked down the street and seen somebody just try to smile at them and watch what happens? They're not going to punch you right up. They're not going to kick you. I have never done that, but that I have not seen somebody, you know, shoulders go back, your steps lighten up. Yeah, some have even started to whistle. It might be the only thing that they have received all day. And selfishly, we can only keep what we try to give away. So I started to do that. I was told the story, too. They said, you might get thoughts of, oh, maybe you can go back and go. Let me try it out again. And they said, we want to tell you this story. It's like, Beth, you were a cucumber growing in a garden. And it rained on you sometimes, and the bugs crawled on you sometimes. You know how it is out there. And then one day somebody picked you, and they put you in a big barrel. And it was dark in there. And it smelled awful. And there was no day, and there was no night. And one day, somebody took the lid off and reached in there and pulled you out, and you were a pickle. That there was no way that a pickle can become a cucumber again. Now go and buy yourself a jar of pickles and keep them in the refrigerator. I still have a jar of pickles in the refrigerator. Isn't the same one, for God's sake. And you know, sometimes I'll open that up and I'll see the pickle jar in there. I'll see what skipper you guys on today. Ha ha ha. You know, these are things that I needed. My sponsors took me down to a duck pond. And they said, what do you see? And I said, ducks. And they said, you're right, what are they doing? And I said, they're gliding along, they're not even making a ripple on the water. And they said, now put your face under the water and open your eyes under there and see what's going on. That was the first time I felt fear sober. You know what it was like with those two? And I had to put my face under that thing for a split second. I wondered if I was ever going to come up or not. You know, but however, faith and fear do not dwell in the same house, so they say. So under it went. And when I came up, they said, what did you see? And I said, their little legs are going around like that. And they said, that's right. If you want that kind of serenity, that kind of gliding along without a ripple, your little legs are going to have to go around too, dear. And that's why, you know, you get active in Alcoholics Anonymous, because if you sit in the corner and suck your thumb, it isn't going to come to you. You got to be a part of. So there's ashtrays to dump, and there's floors to sweep, and there's standing at a door shaking hands, and there's being a chairman, being a secretary. There's all those things. The kitchen duty, that's my favorite thing, is kitchen duty. Because you get there real early, and you meet everybody when they come, and you stay around afterward. And it's a wonderful thing. And I felt like a part of. They told me to build my program with a dry basement and then lay linoleum, which was called the absolutes, honesty, purity, and selfishness and love. We use those up there. And we're never absolutely anything. And I never will, but we strive day in and day out. And they said there's four questions that come out of those absolutes, honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love. And there are four questions that you ought to think about up here before you open that hole in your mouth. It's what you are about to do and say, right or wrong. It's what you are about to do and say, ugly or beautiful. It's what you are about to do and say, true or false, and how will it affect the other guy. I wish I could remember those all the time. Because in a nutshell, I believe today that's God's will for me. To be as honest as I can. To do beautiful things. To be as unselfish and giving as I can. And to respect the other person. Gossip kills. I go once a month to Lima State Hospital. And I visit a woman who is in the corner in a fetal position. She was coming out of a bar once with her little boy. She went in the bar to get him from her husband. And somebody drove by there and saw her. And you know, it's like the old dame of telephone. When you tell somebody something, they don't repeat it the same. In different inflections in the voice. Maybe not saying the whole thing, but by the time it got back to her, said that she was dragging the child out, kicking and screaming and hitting him. She at that time had 3 months of sobriety, folks. She couldn't stand it. And she literally picked up her last drink. Is it kind? Is it necessary? I think life is a looking glass, and what you see in it is a reflection of yourself. Then they told me that the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous had all the answers. And there were musts in there. They said, you're going to hear people say, there's a lot of you betters, but there are no musts. There are musts in there. They made me count them. It took me 2.5 years to come up with the right answer, so I'm not telling you. If it ever gets cold around here, and it snows if it ever does, and you got to stay in your house. Count the moths. There they are. That is the most beautiful love story I have ever read in my life, the big book. I'm on my fifth one. Because I underline the right in the margins, and it changes. It always changes. And it's a story and a way of life given to people who didn't have a chance any other way. It is a miracle of the grace of God and this powerful program of 12 beautiful steps. It's a wonderful book. I love it. Just love it. I was told to read my 24-hour book. We do that up there. I was told when I read the big book to read 2 pages a day out loud so it gets in here, to here, and down in here. I still do that. 2 pages a day out loud. So I'm sure it goes in here and to here and down in here. Same with the 24-hour book. They say read that thought for the day 4 times a day out loud so it goes in here, to here, and down into there. And I still do that. I was told to read Winnie the Pooh, like I said. And I was told to read The Little Engine That Could. And everybody that I sponsor reads Winnie the Pooh and The Little Engine That Could, along with the big book and the 24-hour book. And I wasn't allowed to read anything else for the first 3 years I was sober. Once I looked at a pamphlet. God, they're pretty. You know, they don't make them any old dumb color. They're real pretty colors, and my hand reached for one, and my sponsor cracked me right in the wrist, and she said, "You're not ready for it. I'll let you know when you are." Well, so on my 3rd birthday in Alcoholics Anonymous, my sponsors gave me a box like this that was full of every pamphlet that had the Sermon on the Mount in there and the 12 and 12. And they said, "Get on with it. Get on with it." These are the things that I have got to remember that are very important to me today. Things that I have to continue to do today. And I was told also when I believed so in you, was it at night, to get down on my knees and take off my bedroom slippers, get down on my knees, shove them under my bed and say thank you. And I said, "To who and for what?" And you said, "You've been sober 24 hours. Can't you say thank you for that?" And you'll find out who you're talking to, Toots. Don't push the river. It runs just great by itself. You know, easy does it, but do it. And in the morning, when you wake up and you lay there and you listen to the sounds of the beginning of a new day, did you ever do that? Try it. You hear wind through the trees, you hear breeze waking up, you hear rain falling, you hear the house talking to you, you hear the people you live with breathing. That's life. There was used to be one time when I'd wake up or come to that I was terrified to get out of bed. I couldn't have done that. Try it. It's the beginning of a new day. If you live by yourself and you hear somebody breathing, I'd call 911. I wouldn't screw around with that. And then they said, you know, get on your knees, and while you're grumbling around for your bedroom slippers, remind yourself you're an alcoholic and the problem is you. Ask to make lemonade out of the lemons of life that are bounced your way today, and get up and get on with this thing called living. So I did it because I wanted to be more sober than ever. And I just didn't want to be drunk or dry. And I found out who I was talking to, and I call him God. And I love him. And he's there. And he plays a big part in my life. I'm not a stump jumper or anything like that. I believe. And sometimes, like a couple weeks ago, you know, you really, I have to really do the basic things. Thumb through the books, you know, go on a walk, smile, read the big book, 24 hours. I got to do those and call somebody, share with somebody, listen to somebody. I got to do those things to keep a conscious contact with my God as I understand him. I talk to him all the time. I still get on my knees out of respect. You know, I don't get an answer right away. I got to do footwork first. You know, I just, the task in front of me just isn't as great as that power behind me. You and God's grace. And I had an awful time letting go. I had an awful time letting go. I had an awful time with forgiveness. And it was when I started working on that third step, when I came to believe in a power greater than myself that I choose to call God, that my sponsors helped me. And I could really work through some stuff. I had had a little girl a year and a half after my oldest daughter, and Annie was three, Kimmy was a year and a half, and I was out in the kitchen, and I was pouring the wine out of the thing into different little bottles, and Annie came out in the kitchen, and she yanked on me, and she said, "Something's the matter with Kimmy, Mom." And I told her to go away and leave me alone, that I was busy. And she came back a couple seconds later and tugged. Kimmy had the measles, the bad measles, 3 weeks prior to this. And Annie came back and she tugged on me again and she said, "Mama, Kimmy's turning blue." I hit Ann over across the kitchen and I told her to quit lying, that I said I would get in there when I was done. Neurosurgeons figured that by the time I got into the living room, Kimberly was on her fourth convulsion as a result from the measles. Kimberly retrogressed back to a 3-week-old baby because of the air loss. And she remained that way until she was 8 years old, when by the grace of God she died. We had to put her into a private home. It was 24-hour care. I was pregnant with Linda. And they said, "You have to do this." That was heavy. And I'd had a little boy in 1970. And he lived 8 days and he died. They fed him whiskey out of an eyedropper. They did everything they could. He was born with DTs. He was born an addict. Because his mother drank 24 hours around the clock when I was carrying him. Always telling myself that I wasn't hurting anybody else. They called my husband and they said, "You better come get her," the day after he was born, because somebody put a sign, "Murderous," on my door. That too was heavy stuff. But I learned that God, in his wisdom, had given me a gift, a sobriety. That God, in his wisdom, had said to me, "I forgive you, my child, for what alcohol did in your life." And I figured, along with the help of my sponsors, that who am I not to forgive myself if God has so chosen to forgive me? And I was able to let go totally of the wreckage of my past in that fourth and fifth step. When I learned to let go. My sponsor said to me, "Did somebody ever fix anything for you in your life?" And yes, my old Scotch grandfather. And they said, "Give us an instant." And I remember when the dog chewed the arms off my raggedy and I climbed up into this loving lap of my grandfather with the arms and the body of this doll, and I said, "Grandpa, will you fix it?" I didn't give him orders. on how to do it. I didn't give him a time limit. With the faith of a child, I got up there and said, "Grandpa, will you fix it?" And he said, "My child, I cannot fix it for you until you let go." And I had to remember that 3 weeks ago. I got to remember that all the time. That's how I have to let go and let God, like a child. Like a child. And when I had that ability, then I worked my way for the first time through the steps. And it's an ongoing thing. That's why I'm glad there's 12 months in a year. I can really zero in on one particular step. Step one in January, step two in February, and continue to learn from you guys and from the people that I sponsor and from people out there, from life. I've learned massive things from my grandchildren. I've learned how to run and jump in leaves. I've learned how to sail little things in water after a rainstorm. I've learned how to go and have a chocolate soda and blow funny in the straw so it all comes up through my nose and makes me sneeze. And everybody looks at you like you're crazy, but who cares? You can feel it. This is life. It's living. I never thought I would get to the point when I could hold out my arms like this and children would say, "Grandma, we're so glad to see you." You know, what kind of trouble are we going to get into today? And have fun, real fun. That's because of the grace of God in you guys. It's nothing that I have done on my own. Nothing. Just follow directions to the best of my ability with all the comings and goings. It's a privilege to be sober. And I cannot forget that, or else I get in pea soup the way I was a couple weeks ago. And I did not practice the principles in all my affairs in the beginning. I didn't. I was a wonderful wife and mother. And look at them. You know, who are they to tell me what to do? I'm staying away from the first drink. I'm going to all these meetings. Watch out what you do or say, or I might get drunk. Pushing it in and turning it. And my home group heard about it. And I want to tell you something about my home group. They know what I'm doing and saying when I'm not even there. Really. They come up out of sewers. They hang down out of light. It's like big brother and sister watching you. Did you ever go down the freeway in the morning and you're late? And you know who you get behind? You get behind the Sunday driver out on a Monday morning having a spiritual experience with the abutment. You know, and you can't get around them. Are you wondering what happens to this? The knuckles turn white. I'm thinking of what I'd like to do with that car. And you know, who pulls up beside me? Toot toot. Yoo-hoo. A member of the home group. Yes. And then you have to relax and, God grant me the serenity to accept. They're everywhere. There's a supermarket on Saturday morning. Did you ever go in the supermarket on Saturday morning? Every man in the United States of America is in the supermarket on a Saturday morning. And they hold a basket like this. I don't know why not like this, but like this. So you can't get around them. They say, "Excuse me." And they don't hear you because they're looking at the olives. You know? And yeah, I know what I'm going to do with that basket. After "excuse me" for the third time, I want to ram it right into their ankles. And then you know what comes out of the ketchup bottle? Yoo-hoo! A member of the home group. Oh, yes. So, I mean, they're around, folks. If you don't have a home group, get one. They told me to go home and treat my family like I treated people in these meeting rooms. And I did. I went home and I shook hands. "Hi, I'm Beth. I'm mother." I had this big and four littles. I didn't know who they were. And I found out. And today, because of your grace and God's grace, because you keep me on my toes, we have become a family. And I know that's blessed, and I know that it doesn't happen all the time, but that's how it is. My oldest daughter is 34, Annie. She's married, and they live about 45 minutes away. Billy is 7. Shannon is 15 months. And Ryan was just born. Annie said to me on the day that she was married, 9 years ago, and she stopped by the pew and gave me a hug. She said, "Mother, this is because of Alcoholics Anonymous and the grace of God." I know that. She's one of the best friends I have. One of the best friends that I have. She was the one with a cracked jaw that was wired together at one time. And the grace of God and you guys have allowed us to be best friends. My daughter Linda has gone through a very tough time. Linda chose to leave when she was 18 with somebody who offered her the pot at the end of the rainbow. And through a very long and prolonged divorce, Linda has lost her children. And I support her as much as I can, but Linda has got to do the footwork and be responsible unto herself. And she said to me, "Mom, you know, you've always left the door open." And I appreciate that. And it's because of AA. It's because of God's grace. Because I could forgive myself. So forgiveness in life is not that tough. Bruce is 28 years old. He's a paramedic. I had to make a big decision. He graduated from paramedic school last November, and I was supposed to be in Austin, Texas. And I had to call them in Austin and tell them that I couldn't come because I wanted to be there when my son graduated. That's what I got sober for. And it was a big decision to make, because sometimes ego can get in the way, huh? But I was there, and he got 4 awards that I didn't even know he was going to get. And my heart swelled with pride, because Brucey was in learning disability classes until he was a senior in high school. And to see somebody like that graduate with total score of 98, continual. I know that's because of the grace of God and the power of this program. And he didn't speak to me for the first 3 years I was sober. I hurt him badly physically when I was drinking. You said to me, "Don't squash him, squash him. Keep your hand open. It's like it's a butterfly on there. If it flies away and comes back, you were meant to have it. If it flies away and stays away, you were never meant to have it." And I did it because that's what you told me to do. I kept going to his Little League games. I kept doing things. I'll never forget that very warm July day when his eyes searched the stands and found mine, and he saluted me with a ball. And after the game, he said, "Mom, it doesn't make any difference if we win or we lose as long as you're here." And I could talk with him for the first time. And my son John, the baby, with the 18-and-a-half-inch neck, is almost 26 years old. John is going through paramedic school. John is holding grades in the 90s. John was also a learning disability child. And John has a good job with an ambulance company. And John loves life. And John came into the house one day when I was home early on in my sobriety when he was 7. He said to me, "I want lunch." And I called my sponsor in a panic. I didn't know how to make lunch. I couldn't boil an egg before I had a year. And this little baseball cap and these eyes came up over the counter. And he said to me, "I'll teach you how to make lunch." And she heard him. And again she said, "You came as a child. Let a child teach you. That you gotta crawl before you walk."
And so he took out the peanut butter and the jelly and the bread, and he laid it down, and he spread the peanut butter on this hunk, and he said, "You gotta be careful, Mom, because Daddy says, if you make holes in it, the jelly will fall through and you got a mess." And then he put jelly on this and he put it together and he said, "That's a sandwich, now you make one." And tears pouring down my face. With the help of my 7-year-old son, I made my first sober sandwich. This is living. And things are going on fine, and we're rebuilding what has been destroyed. And then the ugly words of acute myeloid monocytic leukemia came into our home. And for 2.5 years, I watched a man who you had told me to go home and treat like an AA that had developed into the most beautiful relationship. I watched him die. And I watched him die with courage and with caring about us, never complaining. He taught me about an awful lot of things. And a couple of nights before he died, he said, "You want to dance?" And I said, "Yeah." We put on an old Frank Sinatra record. And I held him, and we kind of rocked back and forth. He was over 6 feet tall, and he never weighed under 200 pounds in his life. And he weighed 103 when he died. And we were there, and we felt the closeness and the wonder. And he said, "Beth, isn't it wonderful what God and Alcoholics Anonymous have done for us and are doing for us and will do for us?" I have only the happy memories today. And I miss him. And I remember. And I remember good things because of you and the grace of God. This is the most beautiful way of life there is. In spite of what goes on with life out there, the circumstances of life, if we do the best that we can, if I do the best I can do, with all my mistakes and all my failings, I can get on my knees at night and I can say thank you for the people, for the blessing of one more day of walking in sunshine. I'd like to share a letter with you that my children wrote me this year for my 18th year, and then I'll go to the bathroom. I don't know about you, but get to be this age, you better move when you got to. "Dear Mom, 18 years of sobriety. Have you ever thought of what it's meant to us? It's taught us courage. It's taught us what love means, what faith in all of us just does for us. It teaches us strength. It gives us hope. And the failure is a word of the past. Grandchildren think you are the best there is, Mom, a person to trust. And you tell them they are the best. You tell them silly is okay, and you fix hurts and you mend feelings. You've guided us through the dark valleys. You've told us that AA carries you, where your program has carried us to, Mom, along with our God as we understand him as you do. You showed us the light at the end of the valley and shared your pain and joy and have stuck by us no matter what. You're trying to give us 12 steps to the best of your ability, and you're filling our lives with AA principles and friends. No wonder Daddy loved you so and told us you were a precious moment to him and would be to us. No wonder Daddy loved AA so for what it has given to all of us. Thanks, Mom. We couldn't have done or continued to do this life stuff alone. Simply Mother, to cop a quote. Thank God. Thank God for you. You are the wind beneath our wings." And it's signed Annie and Linda and Bruce and John. This is because of you and the grace of God. And all I can say is thank God. Thank God for you, because you guys, the copper quote, are the wind beneath my wings. And now may the road rise to meet you The wind be always at your back. The sun shine warm upon your face. The rain fall soft upon your fields. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand in the nows of each day. Thank you. God bless you. Have fun.